ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and today I'm joined again by Dr. Michael Behe, author of the brand new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Dr. Behe is a senior fellow with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture and a professor at Lehigh University. He's best known for his previous books, Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, and Darwin Devolves. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks very much, Eric. It's always great to be with you.
So last time, Mike, we were talking about your book, the background for why you wrote this, and the great responses that you provided to critics over the year. This is just a fantastic resource. We talked about how many critics tend to misunderstand intelligent design, and you went through a fair amount of detail about what the real issues there are. And we talked about why some folks are maybe not on board, or at least in public are not willing to indicate why they think that intelligent design might have a point. But we are seeing some strides, and we've seen hopefully some good changes over the years and several prominent dissenters from Darwin and adopters of intelligent design in just the last few years. Let's talk about one of the key issues that people seem to misunderstand as they address this. Specifically, it seems that a lot of your critics, in addition to misunderstanding intelligent design and misunderstanding irreducible complexity, have actually fundamentally misunderstood their own theory, meaning misunderstood what evolution needs to explain. We see simplistic explanations about this or that biological feature, the infamous just-so stories, and just a pervasive lack of detail in providing answers to biological novelty. If evolution is to be taken seriously as a viable and helpful theory about origins, what does evolution need to explain?
Well, the critical thing it needs to explain is how the fantastic, intricate, elegant, sophisticated machinery of life came about. And the main problem, which was recognized by Darwin and a lot of scientists even when the theory was first proposed, is the problem of interactive systems, systems that have a lot of different parts and come together to do something. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that undirected processes, unintelligent processes, you know, they don't have any resources to see into the future, to know what's to be added to what. So that's what the main problem is. For Darwin, it was the eye. He talked about it and he kind of waved his hands and convinced himself that he had an explanation, but it turns out he didn't. But now the focus has moved to the molecular level because science now realizes that life is a molecular phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You see these cooperativity, irreducibility, machinery and such things just fills the cell, fills life at the foundational level. And that's what needs to be explained.
Right, right. So just let me tease that out a little bit. You know, Darwin and Dawkins later look at a few different types of eyes or potentially different sight systems in different organisms and say, aha, that proves evolution. But observing that X exists, or that it exists in different organisms in slightly different ways, is not the same as explaining how it came about, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can't just say, well, I see this and I see that, therefore, because there are similarities, they must have developed by random mutation and natural selection. That's a non sequitur. If you see an insect that has, you know, compound eyes and a person has camera eyes, that doesn't explain where either came from or mm-hmm. whether there could be a transition between the two or any such thing. So there's a lot of imagination goes into Darwinian claims.
Yeah. And this comparative high level anatomy that, you know, Darwin was doing, which of course was the only thing he could do. He didn't know anything about none of his colleagues at the time, nor him, knew anything about the molecular level really. But this comparative anatomy effort that was going on is perhaps similar to or been supplanted by comparative genomics.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we have or science has discovered the molecular level of life and that DNA is the repository of genetic information. And now with the ability to sequence DNA, that is determine the letters, the exact sequence of letters in the genomic instructions of any organisms, what you can do is compare one to another, compare the letters, the sequence of letters from one to another. And a lot of scientists do that and try to build trees of relationship with that information. And they think of as evolutionary trees or trees of descent. And that's interesting and it's fine to do. But what it doesn't tell you is the differences between organisms, what caused differences to occur. And again, the assumption that something could be transmogrified from one starting point to a much more different endpoint by random mutation and natural selection doesn't come from that data. It's in the imagination of the folks who look at it.
But transmogrified, you're bringing in, is this Pogo?
Actually, it's Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, Calvin and Hobbes, okay.
Yeah, he had a box that he labeled a transmogrifier, and it was stuck in my mind.
Yeah, a lot of imagination. That's great. So, Mike, you've provoked ire in some quarters by suggesting that biochemistry is the level where things need to be evaluated and that biochemists, not evolutionary biologists, are uniquely suited to evaluate Darwin's theory. Thankfully, I think things are changing a little bit, but at the time that you said this, it perhaps went against the grain. There was a sense that biochemists were folks who just toiled away in the lab on little specific problems and that a true understanding of evolution should be left to the theorists or the people with degrees in evolutionary biology, maybe the population geneticists and so forth. We've talked about the generic stories about how this or that biological system may have come about and that these don't cut it, like Dawkins or Darwin's example of the eye, a simplistic narrative. What is it about biochemistry that makes it uniquely suited to help us understand the question about whether Darwin's mechanism is actually up to the task?
Well, biochemistry is the study of the molecules of life. And as you say, although Darwin didn't know it, life occurs at the molecular level, or its fundamental machinery is at the molecular level. Darwin didn't know much about cells either. Nobody did in his day. But now we know that cells are run by sophisticated molecular machines. And since biochemistry studies molecules and life is made of molecules, and what's more, evolution is simply changes in molecules in the cell at the foundation of life. A mutation is a change in DNA, the sequence of DNA, mm-hmm. which then affects the composition of the molecular machines that it codes for. So that's the domain of biochemistry. And it turns out that changing those molecules and getting something helpful or better is a whole lot more difficult than evolutionary biologists had supposed. And so I say that it's the job of biochemists to decide these things because it's biochemists that study and appreciate most highly what it really takes to get a viable cell or a viable organism going.
Yeah, and you indicate, I think, that this is not a matter of professional pride. It's just the way things work.
Exactly right. I'm not trying to compete with evolutionary biologists, but the problem is at the molecular level. So that's where we have to look to decide what works and what doesn't.
Well, you've written three major books evaluating the adequacy of evolution and the role of intelligent design. I want to get into your other books a little bit later, but take me back a little bit to your early research, the things you were contemplating and studying and thinking about and researching, even in the early 1990s leading up to the publication of Darwin's Black Box. What are some of the things that struck you or some of the lessons that jumped out at you at the time from your early research?
Well, that's a story. I used to think Darwin's theory was true back in the day and back when I was in school and starting my own lab and so on as an assistant professor, not because I knew how it could explain anything, but because that's what I was told. That's what my professors always instructed me. And, you know, that's fine. Who was I to say they were wrong? But then I read a book by a man named Michael Denton, who's now affiliated with Discovery Institute. And he wrote a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, which pointed out a lot of problems with Darwin's theory. And it's really startled me when I read it. And so I went over to the science library to see who had explained some of the fantastically complex systems that you routinely study in biochemistry. And I was startled to find that nobody had. It was pretty much just a circle of people nodding their heads at each other saying, yeah, isn't evolution wonderful? It produced a blood clotting case. Look, it produced this visual cascade. And nobody had actually done the research. And so that ticked me off. And so I became interested in evolution from there. And in his book, The Origin of Species, Darwin set out a test for whether his theory would work or not. And he said, if there were some organ or system that couldn't be produced by numerous successive slight modifications, that his theory would break down. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking of organs back in the day, but the cell is filled with machinery, and machinery typically cannot be made by many small steps. I mean, tiny, tiny steps, mm-hmm. because much of it is irreducibly complex. So it turns out that we have now been able to test Darwin's criterion, and pretty much everything at the molecular level of life can't be done that way. So
right.
Darwin's test has failed. His theory failed the test. Then when you think about it and you see all of these purposeful arrangements of parts, you know, design simply pops into your head pretty quickly.
Yeah, if there's a willingness to accept it, it comes pretty quickly.
Sure.
So, you know, now some 24 years after Darwin's black box, how do you think your initial thesis has fared? Let me ask it this way. Do you feel like you've had to walk back on the original arguments you made due to substantive criticisms you received, and that the case for design maybe isn't as strong as you had originally thought? Or do you feel like your arguments have held up pretty well?
Well, in my completely unbiased opinion, they've held up. Nobody's been able to lay a finger on the idea. And that kind of really surprised me. Back in the 1990s, when I first wrote the book, I was afraid that somebody would point out some paper and say, hey, didn't you read this? And
right.
this shows that this argument is wrong. But no, over the decades, you know, really smart, very prominent scientists have taken swings at the theory, and they've all come up empty. They've all whiffed. So my confidence in the idea has grown much, much more than it was back in the 90s. And in my recent book, Darwin Devolves, I have an appendix looking back on the 20 plus years, showing that none of the examples I gave in the 1990s, nobody has even tried to explain them in a Darwinian fashion, even though they think it's true, even though science itself has advanced by leaps and bounds since then, at least in explaining how things work. And even though there was this great antagonism toward intelligent design, so that most any scientist would be delighted to come up with an argument against it. So yeah, I think I've said a number of times, the more we know about biology, the stronger and stronger and stronger the case for intelligent design becomes.
Yeah, it just keeps growing. And let me be clear for our listeners, the reason you didn't receive a lot of substantive criticism was not because your argument was ignored. Quite the opposite. It provoked a firestorm and was heavily and extensively reviewed and critiqued in many of the most prestigious publications. There was a lot of criticism and many heavyweights in science community weighing in.
Yeah, that's right. Darwin's Black Box in particular was reviewed in more than 100 different magazines, journals, newspapers,
wow.
New York Times, Nature, the most prominent science journal in the world, Philosophy of Science. So philosophers, they were looking for how the argument held together and stuff. Oh, yeah, that made me nervous. Gee. they said things, but if you read A Mousetrap for Darwin, I respond to all of these things. And it's remarkable. They really have no response. The most common response is that, well, you know, someday we'll figure out how evolution produced this, mm-hmm. or that you're not allowed to invoke design. That's off limits. So therefore, it's not true, which is, again, a non sequitur. But yeah, it's holds up today even more strongly because we know more about biology than back in the 1990s.
And it's fair to say that there's still no detailed account how any of the systems that you discussed in Darwin's Black Box came about. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly correct. And many of the systems I did discuss have turned out to be even more complex than I myself knew, because there are new methods in science to study molecules. And one in particular is a piece of the bacterial flagellum called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint. And it means that it can transfer rotational energy from one plane to a different plane. And there's a remarkable study in the journal Nature showing how it does that. And there's this really breathtaking molecule that kind of expands and contracts and expands and contracts and is just built just terrifically for the job it has to do. And not only haven't scientists explained how the flagellum could evolve, they can't understand even how this one piece evolves. And so, yeah, it hasn't gotten much better for Darwin.
Yeah. So not only is the flagellum irreducibly complex and a problem for Darwin, but even some of the individual portions, individual parts of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We are seeing sort of irreducible complexity all the way down, certainly at the level of the cell and the flagellum and the parts of the flagellum. It just goes on and on. So, Mike, if you'll permit me, I have to share a quick story with you. Back maybe 15 or 16 years ago, I had spent some time studying evolution and this idea of intelligent design, which was new to me at the time. And I got wind of a conference taking place at Biola. So I drove down there from the Bay Area to check it out. And one evening was a presentation and a panel discussion, I think, with a huge audience in the auditorium. And the other evening, there was a celebration dinner honoring Philip Johnson with Lee Strobel as the MC. And you won't remember this, Mike, and I certainly don't expect you to, but I was thrilled to be seated next to you at dinner. Huh. And at one point we got to talking, and I remember you telling me about this new area of research that was just coming to the fore that you were interested in, and that was the area of protein complexes. You'd talked a little bit about some of the individual molecules and how those worked, but the area of these proteins that actually have to come together and work together. And it's now clear that so many of the proteins in the cell work together in sophisticated complexes, revealing yet another layer of design required in the cell. And it sounds like, as you mentioned, things haven't gotten any better for the Darwinian story the last couple of decades.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you're wrong. I do remember that conference. Oh. and we were sitting there and we got dessert, and I kind of turned around and my dessert was missing. And I wasn't sure who had taken it, but now I realize who it was.
My goodness, I didn't remember that part. I must have blocked that out of my mind.
just kidding. Yeah, you're exactly right. That even scientists, biochemists, only a couple decades ago thought that the cell was a bag of proteins that did their own thing. Mm. But with the advance of science, it turns out that a lot of proteins stick specifically to other proteins, like in Lego blocks. And when they are fit together correctly, they make a macromolecular complex. And that just means a bunch of different proteins stuck together to make a machine. So they have to cooperate one with the other to make a machine, as in a flagellum. The flagellum has dozens of different parts, and it's got many, many copies of each, different amounts of each. That's not the exception. That's the rule. Most proteins in cells these days work in complexes of half a dozen or more. And so one has to explain not only the activity, but how the different parts eventually came together to make that machine. With every step, it just gets worse and worse and worse for unintelligent, undirected processes, and much stronger, of course, than is the conclusion of purposeful design.
So one of the criticisms that we often hear is that, you know, design makes no predictions. It's not a real scientific theory. And I was struck as I was reading this book that you had looked at some specific things, I think, with Bill Dembski in a couple of cases years ago, and had made some pretty specific predictions that, first of all, mindless processes will not be able to be shown to produce irreducibly complex systems, such as those found in cells. I think you talked about the binding site proteins. If you have two or more, binding site proteins wouldn't be regularly involved in the evolution of at least vertebrates. And then the time frame required for complex mutations, which is a well-known problem now called the waiting times problem. But these are predictions based squarely on looking at the data, looking at the evidence, and a design-centered understanding of biology. How have these predictions held up?
Well, I'm afraid they too have held up very, very well, just like the argument of Darwin's black box. And again, they're not hard to see. And, you know, I'm a biochemist, but there's lots of biochemists around, a lot of smart folks, and they, I think, are just prevented from seeing these because of the power of this Darwin's idea to kind of block their vision. But yeah, I myself and other folks, David Snoke in particular, who's a University of Pittsburgh physicist and biophysicist. And we wrote a paper showing that if you need just two crummy amino acid changes, amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, kind of like letters in a paragraph, say.
Right.
If you need two specific changes, then it would be expected to take a long, long time to come up with that. And as you said, that's called the waiting time problem. How long do you have to wait for the right mutation to come along? Well, it turns out Darwin's mechanism is just a ticket. It works great if you need just one change. If you have to change just one amino acid, or if you have to destroy just one gene or something.
Yeah.
But if you need two to cooperate with each other before they are beneficial, then it quickly, very quickly loses steam, and it loses steam exponentially. Yeah, we talked about that, and the prediction is still intact. Nobody has shown how such things could happen in a reasonable time frame with a Darwinian mechanism.
Yeah, and just to be clear for our listeners, when you talk about reasonable time frame, you know, just getting a couple of these coordinated changes typically goes way beyond, at least particularly with vertebrates, right? Goes way beyond the amount of time that the fossil record allows for that transformation. And many, many things would have to be in place to change, say, a land mammal into a whale. We're talking about
way more
than two coordinated changes. But even two is a problem.
That's the topic of The Edge of Evolution, kind of the middle book. It was published in 2007. There's a lot of details to get into, but the short of it is that it would not be expected to happen in the time necessary for Darwin's theory to work.
Right. Well, these are some great research questions that came out of being willing to ask these questions based on a design-centered framework. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I'd like to share the wealth. So anybody who wants to come in, it's a fruitful area, and we look forward to many more people taking up the paradigm.
Fantastic. Excellent. Well, Mike, I really appreciated the chance to chat again today. We'll have you back again, if that's all right, to continue talking about this excellent new book.
Terrific. Yeah, I can talk for quite a while about it.
Great. Thank you for listening to ID the Future. We've been talking with Michael Behe, author of the brand new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Get your copy of A Mousetrap for Darwin today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.